I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Is your garden historically correct? Or has it, like so many American gardens, been reduced to lawn and mulch? The horticulturist and our guest, Michael Weishahn, is at the helm of a quiet little HC movement. If your plots suffer from the scourge of what he calls post-war bad taste, including too many clipped hedgerows and Japanese lanterns, you're definitely not HC. Despite good intentions, a growing interest in gardening, and much, much money spent, many green thumbs out there have very little sense of style or cohesion. Michael Weishahn is out to correct that with some lessons from the past. A little tour of the gardens of Old Salem, North Carolina, shows how settlers laid out large, easy-to-work rectangles. Thomas Jefferson was an experimenter at Monticello, always looking to be more productive, though not necessarily always practical. The orderly 19th century garden of Sarah Goodwin in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, was a series of circles and arcs, and it became a whimsical and still ordered Victorian layout. Connection listeners, city or country dwellers, there are good ghosts in your garden. It's time to let them out. We're talking about new gardens and new old gardens with Michael Weishahn. His book is The New Traditional Garden. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK to join the author of A Practical Guide to Creating and Restoring Authentic American Gardens for Homes of All Ages. Welcome, Michael Weishahn. What is our problem, and what is this bad taste thing? The problem surely isn't that we're not spending enough money on gardens, is it?
No, certainly not. We spend more than the majority of any country in the world. It is an amazing amount of money that we dump on our landscapes. And most of it goes into our lawns. We spend huge amounts of money fertilizing and watering and pesticiding our lawns, and the rest of our landscape looks very much like a desert.
I want you to be helpful to people who may just be ready for it. Imagine, I don't know, where do you want to begin? Do you want to begin with a tract house in a burb? Do you want to talk about a three-decker family house in town? Look it over. Weed it, redesign it, liberate the ghost.
Well, I think...
Prune the bad taste, Michael Weishahn, if you can.
I'll do my best. You know, part of the problem is, the whole theory behind the book is that there is an appropriate style of garden for your house. There's probably a really good style that go along with your type of house. There is a couple of bad choices, and there are a couple of mediocre ones. But there's probably one best choice, and I think that's something that we don't talk about very much these days. It's considered a rather elitist idea, very undemocratic in a way, that there's something that's right and the rest of things are wrong. But historically in our country, gardens and houses were designed together. I mean, we're talking about the property. And that was really the key issue. You didn't talk about the outside and the inside. You talked about the whole thing as a single unified entity. And I think that's one of the reasons that 100 years ago and 200 years ago and even 70 years ago, our gardens were so much more satisfying. I mean, there was a real sense of place and unity and cohesion that people felt at home in. Now, a lot of this may have been subconscious. I don't think most people go and analyze a landscape and say, oh, that's a great feature, that's a wonderful focal point, et cetera, et cetera. But what they do is, subconsciously, when you go into a great space that really works from a design perspective, you say, wow, this is really a great place to be in. This is really comfortable. And historically, that's what went on in our gardens and what doesn't happen today.
Take a house and let's build a garden around it. Or take a house... A typical American house may be a freestanding family house in a burb. And tell us what's wrong with the gardens around it.
Well, you know, think about it. We did a series of pictures, actually, from across the country as I've been talking to people. Wherever I go, I take pictures of just typical ranch houses, you know, just standard houses, front entrance, colonials, whatever. And I did a slideshow a couple weeks ago and showed 10 of these pictures from all around the country. And I asked the audience to tell me where these houses were. And the answer was that no one knew because they all looked the same. They are all the same. You have generally a front walkway that leads to nowhere, sometimes no front walkway at all. A line of evergreens plastered up against the house. sort of contorted and pruned, you know, right out of existence. A huge expanse of lawn in the front with nothing much there at all. And whatever gardening activity that goes on is generally hidden away in the back, mm-hmm. out of public view, which is too bad in a sense, because I think, you know, the idea of beautiful cityscapes and townscapes and the idea of a shared landscape is one of the things that sort of connects us to the urban environment. So, you know, you have these things that just these gigantic carpets of lawn that do nothing, foundation plantings that are absolutely boring, very little space to integrate inside and outside. Oftentimes in modern construction, you'll see these gigantic decks, and I talk about them in the book, about these gigantic spiders sucking the life out of a house. You know, they sit two or three stories sometimes off the back of a house to try to transition the levels. There's completely dead space underneath it. There's nothing to do there because, of course, it's dry, it's barren, it's dark. And, you know, you have these great pressure-treated monstrosities that are impossible to integrate into the landscape. You go from place to place and you see this again and again and again.
Okay, the owner of that house says, holy moly, I never supposed that there was a garden implied by this location, by the design of the house. Michael, I get it. I want you to do it. We all know that picture, front walk to nowhere, evergreen sort of standing sentinel, right at the door, open lawn, nothing on it, hidden back garden. Obviously, there's some interest and maybe talent for the game. Design something new to fit that house. What would it look like?
Well, it depends on the style of the house. But, for instance, let's say it's just a simple front entrance, colonial, fairly formal, couple columns out front, you know, symmetrical facade. Obviously, the thing you want is some type of walkway, for instance, starting with a hardscape that's going to link to the house and link to the road and link it all together in a way that is aesthetically pleasing. For instance, let's say the house is brick, and instead of just running a concrete walkway to the front, why not actually do the walk in brick and then use some of the patterns that would have been used in the colonial era? I mean, essentially, neo-colonial houses are, you know, redos of colonial architecture. So why not borrow from that vocabulary and use some of that in the landscape?
Mm-hmm.
They had wonderful paving patterns in the colonial times with different herringbones and running bonds and all sorts of combinations that made what was just a walk-a-day experience into something that's almost like a four-season work of art. So take a dead surface like that and bring it alive. Bring interest into the front. Take away those shrubs that are hiding your house. Historically, most houses were actually quite nude in front. To modernize, they look almost barren. And it's because the architecture was meant to speak, and the landscape was meant to complement. And these days, it's generally the reverse. The landscape overwhelms, and the house is generally hidden behind. You know, it's this typical scenario of the yews that are two stories tall that are, you know, shielding the house from any bit of light and air. So, you know, get rid of the evergreens. Bring in deciduous flowering material. Bring perennials and annuals into the front. Do some of the gardening in the front yard. There's no reason why we should be, you know, spending all our time and energies in the back and really depriving, you know, yourself and your neighbors of this pleasure of gardening. I mean, you pass your front yard every day. Most people do, at least as they come in and out from going back to work. Why not make it a pleasurable experience that says welcome?
And then what about trees?
Well, trees depend. I mean, you know, it depends on the house, but I think that the great problem is, in modern landscapes, is that people don't pay any attention to the wonderful little labels that come attached to the trees that say, this grows to 70 feet, or, you know, this will have a 40-foot spread, and you'll see it crammed up either against a foundation or a whole number of them put together. And, you know, no one believes that things are really going to grow. All gardening is an act of faith in a sense. But on the other hand, you know, there's always this great doubt that it'll really get that big. And so, you know, you go out, you buy that cute little blue spruce. It's tiny. You decorate it the first Christmas or two. You know, by Christmas 5, the thing is, you know, 20 feet tall. And by Christmas 10, you know, you can't get in your front door anymore. So one of the main things is to pay attention to the growing indications on anything that you buy, whether it be a tree or a shrub or flower. They do actually get as big as they say.
Okay. How do you convince Harry homeowner that he really does want to nuke that deck?
Well, I think most people who have lived with some of these big decks for a long time, especially some of these two-story monstrosities that I'm talking about, pretty much want to nuke them themselves. I mean, you're sitting up there exposed to every view, every bit of sun, every bit of breeze. It's really an unpleasant experience. And what you really want to do is get down and participate in the yard and in the landscape. And how do you do that when you're two stories up looking down? Now, sometimes these things are like eyries and they, you know, give a viewpoint over the yard and wonderful perspectives. And that's all fine and good. But if your main living space that's supposed to be in the landscape is isolated from the landscape and you're sort of looking at it like an island, how does that interrelate? I think, you know, just from a safety issue, these things are up, you know, two stories often. You know, we often, when we are called in to redesign these things, inevitably, one of the parents says, you know, I've always hated this thing because I was afraid the kids are going to fall off of it. You know, so it's not actually that hard. When you talk to people and start pointing some of these things out, it's really common sense. People say, yeah, I understand that. You know, I've always been dissatisfied with it. I just have never been able to really qualify what's been bothering me about it. And all you do is have to do is explain this, and it suddenly becomes really clear. And it becomes really clear if you visit some of these gardens, for instance, and take a walk into them and see how they relate. And then you go home and you're really depressed. At least I am. And even with my garden, I garden all the time. I come back, I say, oh, man, you know, there's so many more things I could be doing here.
I want you to just make a couple of very practical points here. How many years will it take for this, you know, Center Hall colonial suburban house to feel and look comfortable in its new clothes, so to speak? And roughly, how much is it going to cost? And then we'll go to callers.
Well. The timing factor is not particularly long. Generally, these things can be, you know, redone certainly within a matter of months, and then they grow in. The whole idea of gardens is that they're supposed to mature into the landscape, into the house, so that it's all supposed to work together over a period of years. But that's part of the enjoyment process. You're not supposed to rush the whole thing. How much does it cost? It can cost anything you want it to cost, in a sense. Good landscapes are expensive. They're like building rooms outside. So they're not at all cheap by any means of the imagination. But I firmly believe that you can take almost any structure and at least improve it, if not redo it.
1-800-423-8255 makes the new traditional garden connection with Michael Weishahn, who wants to break a lot of bad habits, confront bad taste in American gardens, on which we spend, what,
oh, $21 billion a year, I believe.
Why not make it beautiful? 1-800-423-8255. The Gardening Connection. Margaret is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Margaret.
Oh, hi.
Is your garden beautiful?
It's getting there. I just want to say I love the show. And
thank you, Margaret.
I'm grateful to be on. I wanted to ask a question. I have a beautiful spot in Harvard. It has southern exposure, and my house is a colonial revival arts and crafts house that was built as a summer house in 1917. In front of it, in the southern, you know, with the southern exposure, there's a raised terrace. So you actually walk up some steps under an archway to this terraced area, which is like 20 by 50. And it has a nice bow in the front. It's really lovely. And then you walk up some more steps up to the house level where there's actually a porch which looks over the garden. There's lots of trellis and stuff that was built at the time. And when I bought the house 3 years ago, it's basically grassed with some very small beds running around the perimeter. And I'm just curious, you know, I know that it was built, you know, as a summer house. I know it was built maybe as an outdoor room, or I know there was a really deliberate design for this space, but I don't know what it was, and I don't know, you know, I mean, I have my own ideas about it, but I'd just be interested to know, you know, if you have any ideas about how it would have been designed at the time, or what it would have been designed for.
Is there a ghost in that garden, Michael Weishahn?
Well, yeah, there certainly is. And you're absolutely right in the sense that there would have been a fairly intricate design with it. And it was probably designed with a lot of flowers, with a lot of summer interest, plants that would have been bloomed in a time before air conditioning. We were out in the summer a lot more than we are now because it was the only cool place to be. So gardens were often designed with fragrance, especially night blooming flowers that would make the space a wonderful place to be in the evenings. And sometimes if you go, you can find these ghosts, and we talk about this in the book. If you look early in the spring often, you'll see some of the first spring bulbs are very tenacious. They'll last decades and decades, sometimes even centuries, and they'll keep reappearing, you know, through the lawn. And you can see where this actually occurs. We actually were able to recreate in Cambridge once upon a time a whole front driveway layout and the original planting scheme by simply looking at where the crocuses came up in the spring. And from the second story, it was perfectly obvious what the whole layout of the yard had been, given by these wonderful, you know, ghosts that reemerged, you know, once a year. Hmm. It's a neat experience.
Margaret?
Well, I don't, there are some bulbs, there's some, you know, daffodils, that kind of thing. There's not much, I don't think, that's left. There's some old iris, like, you know, the German, the bearded iris. But otherwise, there's not a lot of structure. There were clearly there was a tree on each side of it, and maybe those were elms, but they're gone. It looks out over this field and has old, you know, sugar maples. But that's sort of all that's left. And there's all this, like I said, there's all this trellising. It's on the house, and there are these wonderful arched trellises that you walk under, and those are not planted at all. And even when I talked to the former owners going back 50 years, they didn't know, you know, what had been planted on those.
Well, probably roses, especially in this climate, or clematis, perhaps. An Aristolochia, which is another favorite old vine, the big elephant ear vine. They would have been planted with flowers. Honeysuckle, almost anything, as a matter of fact. You know, one of the ways to go about this whole process, and one of the things, you know, we do talk about in the book, is to sit down with a piece of paper and to draw this out. Things become very clear often in plan view when you look at them, you know, in your mind from above. So if you chart out, you know, how the house sits on the land and all these little elements that are left, oftentimes you can piece together the structure. You know, in times also of drought, that's another interesting time to look at a garden, because when things are very dry, it's like they were last summer, where walkways are and old walls are, often they'll retain moisture and they'll stay greener. So you can sometimes see where the pathways were. And if you chart this out, you know, find out, you know, put the pieces together and see how they relate, and then make them relate for you. That one of the things I feel very strongly is that in a landscape, there is historically correct, as we talked about in the intro, but I don't believe in being a slave to the past either. I don't think you have to absolutely do an accurate reproduction. I think you can evoke pieces of the past and adapt it to your lifestyle, and that's really, really what I advocate.
Margaret?
And that's sort of what I have to do now, and, you know, like, it's a great space for growing herbs, and it's close to my kitchen, so I want to integrate. I don't want to design some sort of garden that doesn't work for my house and how I live.
Stick with it, Margaret. I know it'll work. 1-800-423-8255. Jill is on the line. Hello, Jill.
I'm a very, very grateful mistress of a glorious old English manor home, and
well, that sounds fun.
I beg your pardon?
I said that sounds like great fun.
Oh, it's glorious. It's just, it's heaven on earth. Now it is. But when we first bought the home, the previous owners had actually just raked and pillaged, and it's nothing but horrible, that fake green, if you will. To me, it's just too bright. The green turf everywhere. I mean, it was just hideous. And but to me, just walking in the home, it just spoke volumes about what the gardens would call out for, which is, of course, cottage garden. And hollyhocks in particular. In fact, I dreamed about hollyhocks for a very long time, and now they're everywhere, and I propagate them from seeds and everything. And then I found out since then, actually, just by some research and some luck, that the very first mistress of this home, I consider myself the mistress as opposed to the landowner, because it's a gift, mm-hmm. This land is. But the very first mistress of this home had nothing but hollyhocks. I mean, it was just rampant roses and hollyhocks, which is what my home is now, and I felt so validated, and like I had been very responsible about this home, which made me very happy. And I like to look at things from a legacy standpoint, as far as, like, what will, in seven generations, how will this land will I have left it better or worse? And which brings up my very passionate question, and that's of the $21 billion on those lawn maintenance, I don't know what it is, mm-hmm. How much of that is chemicals? I mean, what's your opinion on that?
Well, a huge portion is. Which is one of the reasons on our program we're not sponsored by Scotts. The real problem is that, you know, we have become a very much an astroturf gardening society. You know, we don't have the patience our forefathers did in letting things mature and letting plants grow and, you know, taking acceptable loss. You know, I feel very strongly, my grandfather used to say, 10% to God, 10% to the bugs, and 10% to the weather. And if anyone except God steps over the line, whack 'em. And, you know, these days we give 0% to everybody, including God, and just we insist that it's going to be right. And if there's a problem, out comes the spray can. You know, out comes the weed turf stuff. I just get a big laugh from these commercials. You see these guys, you know, it's like, I'm so proud. There's not a dandelion in my lawn. And I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, that's great. Your lawn's a desert because there's nothing in your lawn. No, you know, no bugs, no insects, no flowers, no any interest at all. It's just green. And, you know, I like a good piece of lawn. I think lawn is very much like carpeting inside and used judiciously. It's a wonderful thing to have, but too much of anything is not a good thing. And we spend a lot of money making a vast majority of our landscapes very boring.
Jill, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Noah is listening online in Colorado Springs.
Good morning, Christopher and Michael. Another fabulous topic.
Thank you, Noah.
Enjoying it very much. I'm about to move to the big city of New York. And
You can listen online in New York, too.
I hope so. I'll go through withdrawal if I don't. But I'm wondering if Michael has any advice for me about urban organic gardening or rooftop gardening, because I'm very eager to grow some vegetables and flowers and herbs in the city.
In the big city.
Yes, and I will listen offline for your comments.
No, thank you.
Actually, I do. Urban gardening is full of many challenges, and one of the things to pay attention to, especially when you're actually growing food crops, is the soil quality. And not just the normal gardener's worries about making sure that there's sufficient nutrients and compost and other matter, but in urban areas, making sure that the soil is not contaminated. You know, vast areas which have now subsequently become urbanized in New York, here in Boston, Cambridge, all sorts of places, were once quasi-industrial. And even in the 1800s, or 1900s rather, the stuff that they were using, a lot of it got into the soil and stayed there. Lead is a particular problem. Arsenic, you know, heavy metals from, you know, paint. There's all sorts of problems. So if you're doing gardening in an urban environment, the very, very first thing you do is have your soil tested and to make sure that, you know, what you're going to be putting inside you is not worse than what you can buy at the store. You know, the whole point of doing this gardening is generally organic and to grow your own wonderful produce. Sometimes it's more contaminated than the worst commercial production, so you have to be real careful.
Noah, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Chris is calling from Amherst, Massachusetts.
Hello. I have a pretty big front yard and a very tiny backyard, so we put our vegetable garden out in the front yard.
Good for you.
I've been planting asparagus out there over the last couple of weeks. But my actual question here is about, you're talking about historical authenticity and denouncing big carpet lawns around houses. And I'm under the impression that houses didn't really have lawns around them until the invention of the power lawnmower, because before that only the rich could really afford to have lawns maintained, and everybody else just had chickens and sheep and stuff out in the front yard.
You're absolutely correct. The whole mode to a lawn, the whole movement to a lawn is actually very much like lemmings to the sea. And 100 years later, long after the panache has gone out of it, we still go over the cliff just like the lemmings. The process, it was very hard to have a lawn. George Washington had a very small plot of it that he was very proud of at Mount Vernon. It had to be scythed by hand or cropped by an animal. It was very difficult to maintain. What was in a lawn would have surprised you probably. It was anything green. The definition of a lawn was flat, so it could have dandelions or clover or different types of grasses, crabgrasses. They didn't care. They wanted to make sure that it was green and flat. And the main thing was that along came these two English gentlemen who invented what was first a mechanized, although not automatic, you know, gasoline-powered mower, by looking at how wool cloth and the nap was cut off cloth in the mills. And they said, wow, you know, the way the nap is removed could be used to shear a lawn. And then all of a sudden, everyone could have a lawn. You could go out and get a little mower and you could have your lawn. So everyone from maid to minister suddenly could have this little piece of green. And it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then specialized seed mixes were invented, and that helped. And then all the chemicals were invented to help that. And by the time all was said and done, having a lawn, which had been a status symbol only when it was a rare and unique thing, became something that you just had to do. And, you know, it's just
like...
Do
you mean to say that Mr. Toro and his power mower there is driving the whole thing, as well as Mr. Vigoro and Mr., you know, all those dandelion killers are kind of... Are they the root of the bad taste problem?
No, I don't think they're the root of the bad taste problem. They're doing, you know, what American entrepreneurs do and like to do, which is make money. And as long as there's a demand from the American public for these products, someone's going to supply it.
No, but have we been brainwashed by their advertising into the nature of not exactly beauty, but what it is we want around our houses?
I think we've been almost brainwashed by ourselves, and I think perhaps the advertising has driven a large portion of that. Certainly, though, we continue to do this in areas, for instance, like the Southwest and the West, where water is a major issue, where the expansion is continuing, the sprawl that you were talking about earlier this morning is continuing at such a phenomenal rate. Every one of these houses has a Bermuda grass lawn, which sucks up more water than the entire house occupants do.
Michael Weissan, our guest, is trying to take us back to an American model before World War II of a different sort of garden, a beautiful new traditional garden. We'll be back. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the New Traditional Garden Connection with the author and great gardener, Michael Weissan. He's been trying to be polite about saying that Americans spend $20+ billion a year on their gardens and have the ugliest gardens in the world. 1-800-423-8255. What's the problem, Connection listeners? And is it true? Michael Weissan, be quite particular about just what you mean about an ugly, ugly garden. I mean, where and when have you seen gardens you just wanted to go and trample them or rip them all out?
Well, that's a dangerous question, because in general, most American landscapes I'd like to trample and just rip out. You know, you drive down most of our suburbs or any of our roads, and, you know, 1 out of 10, you'll see, you'll see a really good garden. And I want to say it's, I don't want to, I'm not trying to push my particular taste on people. There are gardens that I think are good that are not my particular style, for instance. I don't happen to be a fan of Japanese gardens in North America because I don't think that they jive particularly well with our climate and architecture. But done well, they can be really beautiful. But that's not even the case here. What we are really looking at, by and large, across America is an urban landscape desert and a suburban landscape desert. It is ugly, ugly, ugly. The plant palette consists of maybe 10 plants, tremendous amounts of asphalt and concrete.
Which 10 are you thinking of?
Oh, well, actually, the top three are probably you, you, and you. I mean, the yous are everywhere. And, you know, yous are wonderful plants. They grow into massive, beautiful trees, and they are generally forced up against the foundation and butchered into these horrible little shapes. It's almost like plant sadism in a way. You know, it just, you are really making these things, you know, tremendously unhappy. And all these yous are crying out all across America for, you know, help me, let me out of here. You know, let me grow into the beautiful specimen that I really am. Plant me correctly. Most evergreens actually are these rhododendrons, for instance, especially here in the Northeast. If I see one more of those bloody PJM rhododendrons, those are those little small-leafed ones with a very vivid sort of mauve blossoms that open up very early in the spring. The color is exceedingly vibrant. It shouts at you. They grow, you know, you put them, people put them everywhere. You know, it's not that we don't spend the money and not that we don't spend the time. 67% of Americans list gardening as their number one hobby. 67%.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, that means they're out there puttering in their yard, they're mowing their lawn, they're doing their stuff. They're clipping these ewes down into tiny little you know, pieces, instead of actually doing the things that they should and could be doing and would do if they were actually told how to do this. And people have been helping on this. You know, I kid around a lot about Martha Stewart, for instance, but she's really helped in some ways. In some ways, I don't think she's helped so much, but in some ways, she's helped to at least bring up the American consciousness about the idea of the necessity for beauty in one's life, and beauty in the landscape. It's an important thing. I feel very strongly we need beauty as much as we need good air and water and food to eat. And deprived of that, life becomes very unpleasant for us, and then we seek out other areas of beauty and then trample them to pieces.
There's the premise connection, listeners. Think again about what you're doing to your yew tree and to your evergreens, and probably your rhododendrons, too. 1-800-423-8255. Michael Weishan wants you to think about traditional American models for a very different and much more satisfying kind of garden. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Vivian is on the line.
Hello there.
Hello, Vivian.
I couldn't agree more about the rhododendrons. I, being English, I'm used to seeing wonderful gardens in the front yard full of wonderfully exotic, eye-popping plants. And if you're in a town, that's okay. Please don't do it in your suburban garden. I actually helped to rehab a garden pre-World War II right up on the tip of Cape Ann, right by the sea. I think the maximum depth of soil we had there originally was about 6 inches. And then it was granite all the way through to Australia. But we rediscovered what had been there through the diaries of two ladies who originally created it. And it was so beautiful, indeed, that people used to come in buses from Boston to see this little garden up on, in Folly Cove. No longer exists, but the plans exist. And that's one way of finding out what was in your garden if you inherit, or if you're lucky, are able to buy an old house.
Absolutely. One of the first things to do is take a look at the local historical societies. You know, try to do some investigation and see. Oftentimes there are period pictures that the plans, if you have the plans, is a phenomenal thing. That's pretty rare, especially for smaller sized homes. You know, I think the critical factor is, and I think what the caller's talking about, is this linkage between house and garden, is this idea that the front yard was made to look like it went with the house. And there are so many different ways to do that. The whole book is actually about this type of thing, linking house to landscape. But when you see examples of this, or when they're restored, you know, people walk into these spaces and they say, wow, this is phenomenal. And people do come, or did come, from miles around to see these type of spaces. And you can do it yourself. There's no great mystery here.
Can I put in a word for native plants?
Absolutely.
Especially in suburban gardens, because that desert is not doing much for wildlife in terms of birds and animals and even people. I mean, that all that fertilizer ends up in the water table, and then we have to take it out again. Think about that.
Which native plants are you talking about?
I'm talking about using Camassia instead of daffodils, or red osier instead of the cockroach of the garden for Forsythia.
Now I beg to differ there. I happen to be a Forsythia fan, but I agree.
Cockroach of the garden.
That's provocative. I must admit, Mr. Forsyth would certainly disagree. No, but
taste is a very debatable thing. But I would rather see black-eyed Susans instead of zinnias any day.
Well, I think there's a middle ground. I have a tendency to use some what we call exotics and a lot of native species as well. And I think that, you know, once again, the middle road is where we're heading for here. It is very important to incorporate native plants into your landscape. Part of the problem is that even when gardens are gardened well, there's a tendency to go get a lot of bang for your buck with these really exotic foliages and different types of plants, which unfortunately the native wildlife are completely unaccustomed to using as food sources or shelter or areas of habitation. So that's a real problem for the native animal flora and fauna. So we've got to be really conscious about that. On the other hand, I happen to like zinnias, and I think there's a place for zinnias in the garden. I happen to like daffodils, too. But I also like some of our native plants. Amelanchier, for instance, which is a shadblow, which is one of our native trees, is a wonderful understory small tree that's flowering in the spring, beautiful berries in the summer, which are edible. Not much planted here. Why? Because it's native. We had a tendency in this country, actually, to despise our native plants and plant only what was imported from abroad, then send them back or away to actually be bred and then bring them back again.
Vivian, it's an interesting idea to go with the native plants, the simpler, the older ones. You may be more Michael Weishan than Michael Weishan on that score. 1-800-423-8255. The battle against bad taste in gardens, and Michael Weishan's idea of the new traditional American garden is what we're talking about. Ed is on the line.
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
Welcome, Ed.
Thanks. I just wanted to point out one of the perhaps pitfalls of this notion of being able to describe a perfect idea of beauty in the garden, and that what it seems to do is it takes away this notion of beauty in the eye of the beholder. And then it takes the garden and it puts it in this realm of, say, like the viewing some fine portrait in a museum or reading some fine literature, and that it only becomes accessible at that point to a very sort of limited, I hate to say snooty elite, but that's what it kind of sounds like almost.
Actually, that's actually not what I'm advocating, though. We're talking about just the general creation of beauty. To take the metaphor to art, for instance, whether you want to hang a Van Gogh or a Monet or a Rembrandt, whatever type of style of art that you particularly like, that's fine. I think the problem is, though, most people don't even bother to hang the picture, that our landscapes are essentially blank and barren, and that it's not that I'm advocating one particular style of beauty. I think that, for instance, with house styles, things, there is probably a better answer than others. But I don't really care what type of garden you build. I just want you to get out there and do your garden and do it well and really get involved in the idea of thinking about the aesthetics, not only for yourself, but for your neighbors, the people on the street, the people that pass by.
And what is your style?
Well, I mean, I'm not much of a gardener myself. I have tomato plants growing on the balcony of my apartment.
That's a good sign.
Other than that, I guess what I still don't see it. For instance, if you were to take, say, literature and the broad spectrum of literature, there's, you know, good literature perhaps for some people and not for others, and it kind of gets dangerous because then what it says is, well, there's only one kind of literature that you should really focus on, and or maybe it suggests that that's the case anyway.
No, I don't mean to suggest it at all. What I'm suggesting is that not that there's one good kind of literature, that the fact that the people just aren't reading. You know, we aren't even to the level of actually talking about, you know, what's better or best, and this is a more elevated kind than the other. What we're talking about here is that people aren't getting out there and thinking about this linkage between house and garden, aren't thinking about the general aesthetics of their property, aren't thinking about pulling this stuff all together. And really importantly, and something I do want to talk about, is this idea of public beauty, of creating spaces that are not only for yourself, but also for other people, that you can appreciate as you drive by, as you walk by. You know, it's not that people are advocating one type of literature over another, or one type of art, is that they're not even bothering. You know, they're not even trying, and that's what has to change.
I don't want you to get hung up about the elitist thing here. I mean, it obviously helps to inherit an English manor house or a gorgeous Victorian garden, but it seems to me it's not about haves and have-nots exactly, because some of the best gardens I see around Boston are, I mean, any place with a sort of big Latin population, Italian, Haitian, Greek, Hispanic, a whole lot of gardening know-how goes with them, and they have beautiful gardens, front yards, porches. Somerville, Massachusetts is a hotbed of
absolutely
wonderful gardens. A lot of poor neighborhoods know what this is all about. There's the gap in the middle somehow that's forgotten the beauty.
Well, I have a theory about that. And my theory is that the poorer people, the people who have just come over from other countries, lived in much more immediate proximity to their landscapes. And the landscape was an important thing for them. And now we have removed ourselves by a generation or two or three or four from this idea of being close to the soil, of working with the soil, of understanding the land. How many people really think of their landscape as land, as earth to be cultivated and made productive? Very few people do. The people who are poor by necessity have to pay attention to that, and the people who are in touch with those traditions that are still very strong in Europe do it also. But the average American has sort of forgotten about this. We're just too far removed.
Michael Weishaupt is here to remind you. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Jack is on the line.
Yes. Good
Hello,
morning.
Jack.
This whole program is stimulating hundreds of thoughts running through my mind about...
Wow. Write them down, Jack.
...and landscaping. But I had a good one, and it's been touched upon a little bit. We have terrible soil in New England. In most places, it's sandy, rocky. Some places are blessed with better soil than others, but I'm not. And what saved me is composting. I just have a quote here. A few years back, I was in Mount Vernon, George Washington's home, which you mentioned before, and they used to sell a great T-shirt that on the front said, "Compost happens."
Exactly.
On the back, now, they stopped selling them. I was told they're politically incorrect.
Oh?
But on the back, they have a really good quote, and I'm going to read it here. It says, "A knowing farmer who, Midas-like, can convert anything he touches into manure at the first transmutation towards gold." Oh, excuse me, as the first transmutation towards gold. And that was from George Washington in a letter discussing the qualities he sought in a farmer. The man had it figured out back then, is composting. It's another way of getting in touch with the soil, as you said, your land. I find that just about any food product that I can get out of my house gets composted. That now becomes fertilizer for my vegetable garden. And I do have a lawn, not a big one. I'm trying to actually cut back by making more gardening and hedging. But now I've gotten to the point where I'm actually composting enough that I should probably next year be able to top dress my lawn instead of fertilizing it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we have I have a chapter in the book called Soil is Everything. I mean, soil is the starting point for gardening, and composting is the starting point for soil. And whether you do that by saving the horse manure like we do, or whether you compost your veggies and other things from the kitchen, without good soil, you really can't begin this whole process of discovering the land and discovering your own landscape. And it's really critical. And it is not achieved by going out and buy a bag of 10-10-10 either. That's sort of like taking a little dose of steroids. You get some quick results, but there's no long-term buildup. There's no long-term growth. You don't get the lushness that everyone wants, but no one can seem to achieve. The chemical way is not the way, and it begins with compost. I don't think that's politically incorrect at all. Do you?
Jack, thank you. And good luck. Thank you for calling The Connection. 1-800-423-8255. Pamela is on the line.
Hello.
Hello,
hi.
Pamela. Welcome.
I don't have a fabulous Victorian. I have a fabulous 1960s split-level raised ranch.
That sounds great.
Yeah, we like those two.
And we just moved in 6 months ago, and we've spent the entire time ripping out poorly placed hedges and poorly planted trees, and ripped up 190 by 50 feet of lawn to plant a vegetable garden. Hmm. And it comes under beauty is relative, I think, because the neighbors were horrified. Hmm. And one big problem we have is we can't seem to protect ourselves from the chemicals that everyone else is using. Hmm. We're kind of on a downslope, and there's Chemlawn and ant killer and a golf course, and wondering how you keep yourself safe from these things. Or what do you suggest? I mean, willows or something to suck everything up?
Well, obviously, buffer plantings along the proximity of the property line will help. But it's a very important issue, and one that we don't address often enough, is that there's a tremendous amount of drift in water runoff, in air, in breezes that, you know, blow over this type of stuff. What I think the solution is to talk to people about more responsible use of these chemicals. That the ideal landscape is not one that is bathed in chemicals. And, yeah, I mean, I occasionally spray something, too. I don't have a totally organic approach. Sometimes things step out of line, and there's no recourse. Either that or you lose the plant. You make that decision. But I don't believe in this constant use of these chemicals. And what do? You pray, essentially, and you try to get other people involved to get rid of those chemicals in your environment.
Are you a no-chemical fertilizer guy yourself?
Pretty much. We do a little bit. I occasionally use chemical fertilizers just to supplement a little if I think there's a problem, but only as a temporary thing. It's not a fix. It's a little jolt in areas where we haven't done enough soil preparation or there's some deficiency in the soil, iron or magnesium or something like that. But very rarely, because really, if you have good compost and good soil and add a lot of manure and work on your soil, it shouldn't be required.
1-800-423-8255 with Michael Weisshahn, the author of The New Traditional Garden. Carol is on the line.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question. You mentioned some native plants, but could you give me the names of some native flowers, perennials, that I would be able to plant in my garden?
Oh, well, there's a whole list. And actually, the funny thing is, as you know, we started to talk about, a lot of them were sent away and came back with European names. The ones that come immediately to mind are the black-eyed Susans. You know, they come back to us named like, Sommerhurst and, Sonnenschein and all these things, because the Germans have been very active in breeding different varieties and then send them back to us. But black-eyed Susans, for instance, most of the daisies, Leotris, which is one of my favorite plants to use in the garden.
Which common name is?
I think the common name is actually Leotris. Something like spike flower, but that's an easy name. Liatris is a wonderful prairie plant that makes a terrific addition to the garden. Not particularly demanding, very floriferous over a long period of time, not very much tolerant or resistant to very resistant to drought. So there's all sorts of plants. There are so many books available today just on this subject. There's a whole host of plants that have come literally from our prairies and woodlands and are now part of our gardening vocabulary. We should be using more of them.
Great. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Carol, thank you. Julie is on the line.
I have two quick comments. I'm a landscape designer, and one of the ways I came to it was my travels in Europe and South America. And I want to say that gardens are not just for the rich, because I was so impressed by the poor people that had the most exuberant and beautiful gardens. So money is not the issue.
Absolutely.
And number two, a wonderful new book on native wildflowers by Bill Colunia from the New England Wildflower Society.
Yes.
Has just come out, and that's a wonderful source for getting ideas for what to plant in your garden.
Yes.
Okay?
Absolutely.
Julie, well done.
Thank you.
Actually, we just talked with him not too long ago, and he's an amazing resource, and the book is really, just was published this year by Houghton Mifflin, is a wonderful book that talks about using Native American plants all across the country in standard garden situations and wildflower gardens. It's a really great book.
Michael, can I ask you what time we have left? Where does a gardener go, a modest, not going to be professional gardener go, other than to the garden store, specifically because the garden store has got a whole lot of rhododendrons, evergreens, yews, and chemical fertilizers that they're going to want to sell you. Where can you go short of the White House landscape advisor to get sound counsel on exactly and specific suggestions on exactly what you've been talking about?
Well, there's a whole host of books out there, including my own. That's obviously the first place to take a look at. But, the gardeners have embraced the Internet in an amazing way. When AOL first started, the two things that actually kept it alive were the sort of chat room situations and gardening were the two biggest users. And there is a tremendous resource available.
Interesting. What's your favorite site?
Oh, our own.
All right, name two more.
Garden.com, I think, is a great site. There's thousands of them out there for good advice, good products, a wonderful set of information.
Michael Weisshahn, this is fun. It's a wonderful book, The New Traditional Garden, A Practical Guide to Creating and Restoring Authentic American Gardens for Homes of All Ages, not to mention all sizes. Michael, thank you.
My pleasure.
You can continue talking about New Traditional Gardens on our website at theconnectiononeword.org. Thanks for help today from Glenn Alexander, Allison Bagg, John Hoder, Dan First, Thomas Terry, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. The Connection Gardeners are Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hatti, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our senior greenskeeper. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUF Austin. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR. Coming up on Here and Now at Noon, in addition to all that's news, a special report on Catholic thought and film, as Father Richard Blake of Boston College explores how Catholic